Okay, good evening, everyone. We are in part two of our explorations through the question of whether the mitzvah of Amalek, remembering, not forgetting, annihilating Amalek, still applies today. In particular, the mitzvah of destroying Amalek. Now, let's do a little bit of a recap of what we learned last time. But before that, I want to address a question. Phyllis, who I'm sure she'll be joining us shortly, she asked the question, which is, it says that there's a mitzvah of Zachor, to remember what Amalek did, and also Losishkach, not to forget what Amalek did. And we know the Torah isn't superfluous. In fact, these are two distinct mitzvos. So in what way are they different? So actually, if you look in the Rambam, which we quoted the Rambam last time, but we didn't look at the entire halacha, so it's not in the material I gave you, but right here in the Mishnah Torah right in front of me, Rambam, Hilchos Malachim, Perik Hei, Halacha Hei, he says, Mipi Ashmua Lamdu Zachor Bapeh, Lo Sishkach Balei. So we have a tradition that says the mitzvah of Zachor, of remembering, is by mouth. Hence, we read Parshas Zachor from the Torah with our mouths. And lo sishkach is balev. And lo sishkach is that we shouldn't forget it in our hearts, even when we are not saying it. So the mitzvah zachor, we only need to do it once a year. Chazal said, well, if we're going to do it once a year, it makes sense that we should try to do it right before Purim. Because the Gemara tells us, I think it actually makes sense, it'd be Megillah, so we'll get there soon, maybe a Gimel, if I'm not mistaken, says that Haman was a descendant of Agag, who we'll talk about soon, was a descendant of Amalek. And so that, we lay Parsha Zachor, it's apropos to read it before Purim, in which the antagonist of the story of Purim is supposedly a descendant of Amalek. So that's number one. Number two, we're not getting into it so much, but there's a discussion about, do we really need to annihilate everybody from Amalek? I realize I probably should have addressed it during the first year because you may have walked off with the wrong impression. There is actually also an opinion in the Rambam that we don't necessarily need to kill every Amalek. An Amalek who's abiding by the Shemesh B'nei Noach, by the seven Noahide laws, might be spared. And additionally, Rambam is of the opinion, actually, that Amalekim can actually convert to Judaism. This is a huge machlokus. It's a very controversial position that Amalek could convert to Judaism. But the Gemara Megillah tells us that the children, the descendants of Haman, were learning in Bnei Brak. So I remember, you know, like many years down the line, they all became a bunch of from Yeshiva Bachrim and Kol Younger Light, and had 10.5 children living in Bnei Brak and learning Torah. So how is that possible? Presumably, they had converted. Can you convert someone from Amalek? So Rambam uses that to support his position. There's other ways of understanding it. But I just wanted to let you know that even with the mitzvah of annihilating Amalek applying to you to a certain degree, there is an escape hatch for someone. They're not completely condemned just because the luck of the draw got them into the nation of Amalek. So that I probably should have mentioned last time, but nonetheless important to note now.
Oh, Rabbi, let me ask you.
Yes, Lloyd.
That Amalek can't be annihilated because we need a refuge for all the evil people that exist, and we always call them descendants of Amalek. So if Amalek is liquidated or completely wiped out, then we won't have anybody to assign all these evil people to.
Well, what do you mean? So if we don't have Amalek around, what we learned last time, you know, I think, boy, this transitions well into our recap. What we learned last time is, so the Rambam in Halacha Daled says that there is a mitzvah to destroy the seven Canaanite nations, but Kvar Avad Zichra, Rav explains, we don't know who they are today. I don't know about you. I can't identify which Arabs descended from the seven Canaanite nations and which ones were from other Middle Eastern, ancient Near Eastern nations. So functionally, it doesn't apply anymore. However, Rambam does not write Kvar Avad Zichram for Amalek, which suggests, unless you hold like the Minchas Senach, it suggests that the mitzvah of destroying Amalek still applies today. And so we brought in the famous position of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, Reb Chaim Brisker, which was interpreted by his grandson, Rav Yosheber of Yosef Dov from YU, and Rav Moshe Sternbach from the other end of the Orthodox spectrum of the Eidah Haredus in Yerushalayim. You don't really, you could see, I guess, a little bit of ideological difference here. Rav Soloveitchik interpreted his grandfather as saying that anyone who wants to destroy the Jewish people has a status of Amalek today. So he used that to explain that the Nazis, Yimach Shemam V'Zichram, they are, you know, the heirs of Amalek. Any nation that's hell-bent on destroying the Jewish people and waging a war with God and his people, then they have a status of Amalek today. However, Rav Moshe Sternbach, he had a slightly different take on this. He says that anyone who has the ideology of Amalek is considered Amalek today. What does that mean, the ideology of Amalek? We have an imperative to destroy the shita, the ideology, and the hatred for God, that they claim that God doesn't exist, or at least God does not have any providence in this world. The world is all just happenstance and coincidences. And so our job is to destroy the ideology, which actually is more moderate than Rav Soloveitchik's understanding of his grandfather. Because according to Rav Soloveitchik, you have to destroy the modern day incarnation of Amalek. Whereas according to Rav Moshe Sternbach, you don't necessarily need to destroy them physically, but it's to destroy them ideologically. Nonetheless, anyone who's following along in the actual material, page Sadi Dalad, footnote Mem Hey, he quotes from Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yikom Damo, who perished in the Holocaust. He was a student of the Chavetz Chaim and a great, one of the greatest Talmudists of recent years, period. Rav Elchanan Wasserman is amazing. Now, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, there's a collection of his writings called, aptly named, Kovetz Mamarim. And in his essay, Orni Masi Lamelech, he talks about how, you know, it used to be, I'll read for you the actual language. It's an oshei. He says, El Shabadoras Hakom and Eis Sultan Ator B'Yisrael, Nala Machama Zer Amalek Me'umasa Olam. It used to be our conflict with Amalek was there was the Jewish people versus an external threat called Amalek. Almeisha Paraknu Old Hator Mimenu. But nowadays, where so many Jews have thrown off the yoke of Torah from themselves, Shirtzu Zera Amalek B'Socheinu. Amalek's descendants have begun to proliferate within our own midst. Nisrabu beinenu amurin lahachis. And so now there are heretics who are ideologically opposed to God and opposed to Judaism who have appeared within our very own midst. And then a few osios later, in os tes and os yud, he writes, so what kind of action can we take against them? Like, think about that. If you're calling fellow Jews Amalek, what's the logical conclusion? What's he basically sanctioning? Well, what's our mitzvah? What was that? What's our mitzvah vis-a-vis Amalek? What are we talking about? It's not a trick question.
Destroy.
Who said that?
Arlene,
100%. Oh, if you're from the side over there. 100% correct, Arlene. To destroy. In fact, that's what he writes. Ha'itza amitis hili lochem negdom bizroa mamish b'mesiras nevish ariga. And we have to fight against them. We have to take arms against them. But then he gives the caveat. Avol k'medumeli l'fi matzav k'eis kosher l'kayim ha'itza hazos b'poel. But, you know, we don't have the means to actually wage a war physically. So what's he saying in the end? Like any good Rosh Hashiva, we should learn Torah, and learning Torah will help us. Okay, that's always the answer. Now, this is fascinating. Rabbi Chanan Wasserman believes in principle. I mean, if we take him at his word, we assume it's not just rhetorical. He's actually asserting that the din of Amalek doesn't just apply to non-Jews nowadays, but can actually apply to Jews who are ideologically trying to destroy Judaism. Now, he does clarify in that essay, he doesn't mean that the average non-observant Jew, God forbid, we should be trying to get rid of them. That's not what it means. What it means is, you know, most people don't think in a sophisticated manner about what they do in life. Most people don't introspect deeply about theology. But so, you know, they kind of just, whatever they're raised to do, whatever their community does, they're just in it for the ride. But what it means is that there are people who are the leaders of these ideological movements, who oppose God. The leaders, the ones who are propounding this heretical ideology, which is the Hachiz, which is in spite of God, they have a din of Amalek, he says. I am not going to start listing people nowadays who fall in that category. This is recorded and could get me in a lot of trouble. And I'm definitely not condoning any violence. Let me repeat myself again before I get in trouble. I'm not condoning any violence against anyone, period. Done. But if we were to accept Rav Chanan Wasserman's formulation, his framework, there are Jews from a traditional halachic rabbinic standpoint who would be considered heretics, mumarim lahachis, and according to Rav Chanan Wasserman, they'd have a din of Amalek, and we'd be chayav to take action against them. So this is a step further than Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim only applied Amalek to other nations. Reb Chanan takes a step further and says, even people within our own midst. Wow. That's a radical application of Amalek. It started off as this little subsect from Esav, and now it can be even Jews within our own nation. That's wild. Okay. So I want to go now to there's a mechilta. Those who are following are Tzarihei Osvav. And I want to give a third answer. Remember, what was our fundamental issue here? Our fundamental issue is that the Rambam seems to posit that there's no application. We cannot identify Canaan nowadays. So there's no mitzvah to destroy anyone from the seven nations. But he implies that there's a mitzvah to kill members of Amalek today. But you can't have your cake and eat it. Either we can identify people from the olden days, or we can't. It doesn't make sense to say, I can identify a Malakian, but I can't identify people from the seven nations. I mean, if you have the access to the DNA test, then it just doesn't, you know, what's the distinction? So our initial answer was, a Malak applies nowadays, just not to the original nation, but to people who accept their vicious ideology, however we want to understand it. But we're going to give a third approach, which is different than the first two, to reconcile this difference. The mechilta on the pasuk, on the words mitachas hashemayim, that we're supposed to destroy Amalek from under the heavens. It says, shlo yehi nin v'nechla Amalek, tachas kol hashemayim. There should be no grandchildren, there should be no descendants of Amalek alive ever under God's heavens. That's our mitzvah. And the question that leaves us with is, well, I know that already. What's the mechilta adding beyond my basic understanding of the psukim, which seems to imply that God has a war against Amalek and we're chayav to destroy all of Amalek? What is the mechilta? What's rabbinic literature coming to add to that which I would not have assumed otherwise? And furthermore, if that is true, why don't we get the same kind of commentary on Canaanim as well? So this is our third approach. The third approach to distinguishing between Canaanim and Amalekim is that the mitzvah, I'll read out loud, Venir Levar, this is Os Zion. Venir Levar, the Shani mitzvah hachroma Zion Amim and mitzvah mechiyetz Amalek be'ikr yisoda. The mitzvah hachroma Zion Amim yisoda min hachroma Zion ha'umos. What's the mitzvah vis-a-vis the seven Canaanite nations? To destroy the nations. Dahainu ibur klal ha'uma, to make sure that there's no longer a nation called the Amori. There should no longer be any of the seven Canaanite nations. Ma she'en kein mitzvah mechilas amalek yisod ha'mitzvah hu la'abed as zichra mikol v'kol. Whereas the mitzvah vis-a-vis Amalek is not just stop, destroy the nation of Amalek, but it's to destroy the zecher Amalek, any remembrance of Amalek. And that applies on the individual level. You see, nowadays, since no one can look around and say, ah, there's one of the seven Canaanite nations over there, they've all dissolved, they've all reconstituted themselves into new different nations. There's no longer the seven distinct Canaanite nations anymore. Therefore, we can say, yes, there is a mitzvah to destroy the seven Canaanite nations, but mission accomplished a long time ago. Whereas Amalek is not vis-a-vis the national unit of Amalek, but it's vis-a-vis each and every individual. That's what the Mechilta is coming to tell us. There shouldn't be a nin v'necher of Amalek left.
So Rabbi, excuse me, what is the lo tishkach ad? Did we discuss that yet?
Yes, we answered it at the beginning. In fact, oh, I give you a shout out, but I'll let you know again.
I'm sorry, I missed the very
not a problem. Not a problem. So the difference is that Chazal say, and Rabbi quotes in the halachos here, that zachor is bepeh, with your mouth, so that's when we lean it. And osishkach is belem, is in your heart.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for making sure we circle back to that. Okay. Now so this approach is great. Now I understand why Rambam says kvar avad zichram, why the mitzvah vis-a-vis cannot no longer apply. And now I understand why vis-a-vis Amalek, it does still apply because the individual still exists, even if the nation of Amalek is no longer identifiable. And with this, we can resolve an issue that comes up in Sefer Shmuel. So we remember in Sefer Shmuel, which I guess is a good plug for Remark Waxel's shir at 8:00, which I believe is Sefer Shmuel, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes,
so, I'm just giving you a preview right now for Mark Waxel. So the story is that Shaul, King Shaul, he preceded King David. He's the first king of Israel. Shaul sets out with his military to wipe out Amalek, to fulfill his mitzvah. In fact, that's a big reason why you appoint a king, to wage the wars. That might even be the most fundamental, the fundamental goal of having a king, to wage the wars of the Jewish people. So Shaul leaves, you know, he kills out almost everyone, but would you believe it, he leaves Agag, their king, alive as a captive. And Shmuel comes, and Shmuel is enraged. How can you leave all these sheep alive? How can you leave Agag alive? You didn't listen to God. And so Shmuel himself actually finishes the job and kills Agag. But unfortunately, as we understand, that Agag, during his time in captivity, he had the chance to impregnate a woman, and she bore his seed. And that's how the line of Amalek was able to continue, and that's how we have Haman, how we had Haman in the story of Purim. But the question is, you know, Shaul almost finished a job. Why did he bother keeping Agag alive? If he was able to, you know, if he was fine wiping out everyone else, I would think Agag, the king of the Amalekim, shouldn't be such a tall order for him. So Rav Yonason Eipshitz in Ahavas Yonason says, near the Shaul ta b'mashe hichya es Agag, made Agag imo haisim in Amalek. What was Shaul's mistake? Shaul assumes that unlike Jews, for non-Jews, we determine one's national identity based on patrilineal descent, based on their father. But came along, and so Agag's mother was from Amalek, but Agag's father was not from Amalek. So Shaul said, since non-Jews, their national identity follows patrilineal descent, not matrilineal descent like Jews. And his mother, it's only his mother that's there. I'm like, not his father. Then I don't have a mandate to kill him. I don't have a right to kill him. Just like anyone who is not from Amalek. He's not from Amalek because only his mother's from Amalek, not his father. However, and therefore comes along Shmuel, and Shmuel says, no, we go based on the mother's line for the non-Jews. He's from Amalek, and that's why he kills him. Here's the issue, though, that basically everyone asks on Rav Yonason Eipshitz. If you look in the Shulchan Aruch, in Eben Ezer, Siman Dalet, Sif Zion, it says black and white that no, actually non-Jews do not follow matrilineal descent. They indeed do follow patrilineal descent, like Shaul thought. Amoni shenasa isha mitzris. If an Amoni marries an Egyptian woman, havlad Amoni, the child is considered from the nation of Amon, because the father is from Amon. Umitzri shenasa Amonis, and an Egyptian man who marries a woman from Amon, havlad mitzri, their child is an Egyptian, because the father is an Egyptian. Sheba umos haloch holech acher hazachar. For when it comes to the nations, unlike Jews, they follow patrilineal descent. Im kein, nimsa the shabrit son, shobo mashiach yesagag. If so, question number one, wasn't Shaul right then? Shaul had every right to leave Agag alive, because Agag's father was not from Amalek, and Goyim followed the father. That's question number one. And then question number two is, if Shaul was right, what was Shmuel HaNavi thinking? What's the prophet Samuel thinking when he came and killed Agag? No, did Shmuel not look in the Shulchan Aruch and see the din over there? He didn't look in the Shulchan Aruch because it didn't exist yet. But if we're assuming, if we're going through the halakhic framework over here, the Shulchan Aruch is written many, many years later. We're closer to the Shulchan Aruch than Shmuel is, just to give you an idea. So that's the question. So we could use our framework now to resolve this. Remember how we talked about the mitzvah to destroy the seven nations was only vis-a-vis the national unit versus Amalek. Amalek was vis-a-vis every individual. He says in Osi Gimel, Revulsion says, "De ein hochinami de ba'alman amrina de ba'umas holich achar hazachar." Yes. In general, like the Shulchan Aruch Paskins, Goyim follow patrilineal descent to determine their national identity. For instance, if we want to determine if someone was from the seven Canaanite nations, we would do it based on whether their father is from Canaan. Mikol makom shani mitzus mechias amolek. Whereas Amalek is unique. What did Rav Yonos and Eifetz mean over here? What is Shaul's mistake? Shaul thought that when we determine if someone's from Amalek, we use the same metric, we use the same criterion as we do for any other non-Jewish nation, patrilineal descent. But what's different about Amalek? Masha enki legabe mitzvah mechias Amalek holich ach holchim gam acharim. When it comes to Amalek, we don't only look at the patrilineal line, but we look at the matrilineal. We look at its mother as well. Why? Even though vis-a-vis national identity, we go based on the father for non-Jews. And by the way, that's how it works for Shvatim as well. For Jews, the Shevet follows the father. Yeshbo mitzvahs mechias Amalek. Nonetheless, when it comes to the mitzvah mechias, like destroying Amalek, ki sod mitzvahs mechias Amalek hu la'avi es zecher Amalek. Because what's the mitzvah of Amalek? To destroy Amalek as the zecher of Amalek, the remembrance of Amalek. Belo ha'uma shamalek, not just the national unit. Ukevan shesof kol sof, imal shavlad ze Amalekisi. And since Agag, yes, his father may not have been from Amalek, but since his mother was an Amalekis, Yeshbo Gamkin Zecher Amalek, he is considered a Zecher of Amalek. Therefore, that's what Shmuel HaNavi was saying. And Shmuel HaNavi was saying that you're right, Shaul. It doesn't really sound like this well in the dialogue in Sefer Shmuel, but you can ask Mark Waxel what his thoughts are on this take. National unit is determined based on the father for non-Jews. But if we're trying to eliminate the Zecher, then we all of a sudden become very egalitarian. We look at the father and the mother. And if one of them is from Amalek, even the mother in this case, then he is Amalek for all intents and purposes. That's what Shaul's mistake was. Shaul thought we only follow the father for Amalek, like everywhere else. Kamash Malan comes along Shmuel and told us otherwise. But what's the importance of the Shita? The importance of the Shita is, why does, let's go back to our original question. Why did Rambam say that the mitzvah of destroying Canaan no longer applies because the national unit of Canaan, of Canaan's nations, no longer exists. But Amalek, which is about eliminating the Zecher, that still applies today, arguably to the national unit as well, even if we're not capable of identifying them. But nonetheless, again, I want to reiterate what I said at the beginning for those who may have missed it. An important qualification to all of this that I really should have mentioned during the first year, which is Rambam's of the opinion, by the way, that someone from Amalek could convert to Judaism. At the very least, if he's keeping the Shemitz B'nai Noach, he might not be subject to being to death like other Amalekim. In fact, as we mentioned, Haman's descendants were learning in B'nai Brak. They became from Kolel people. I remember when I was in high school, my Rebbe was teaching this Gemara, and he said, yeah, you know, there's this politician in Israel, I think it was Tzipi Livni, it was someone from one of the more like labor liberal parties in Israel. He said, you know, oh, she's like terrible for all the Yidden, but her children, Baruch Hashem, they saw the light, now they're all learning in B'nai Brak and Kolel. And he compared it to Haman. I'm not sure if it's as comparable, but he definitely saw the analogy there. So do I end off with a blessing that all of our grandchildren should be learning in B'nai Brak? I'll let you guys figure it out for your own families. But that brings us to the end of this is part two out of two of Amalek. God willing, next time we will talk about women and the mitzvah of Megillah. As guys, I ever tell you my this cheap marketing strategy I figured out? I call it the women and principle. I think I've shared this with you guys. The women and principle. I coined the term. We'll see if it catches on. Is imagine I was posting on the Shul Bulletin. The main title of the shiur was The Mitzvah of Megillah. So, you know, maybe 3.5 people show, or, you know, you guys are great. You show up to everything. But when you title as Women and the Mitzvah of Megillah, all of a sudden, like, you sell out all the tickets. People are banging down the doors to get it. You know, dude, try this with anything. I guarantee you. The mitzvah. Imagine the mitzvah of shofar. And I was like, oh, the shofar. Oh, who cares about that? Women and the mitzvah of shofar. I only figured this out because I noticed that I did this myself unwittingly a few times, and I'm going to be guilty of that next week. But it came up in our Thursday night Gemara Megillah shiur, so I figured I'd look into the topic and I'd share it. And I hope you'll all enjoy it. So that's what we're doing next time. And then starting in the second half of February until Purim for 4 weeks, Shoshim Kod Mechag, it'll be advertised soon. Me along with three of my younger rabbinic colleagues, you haven't met any of them yet. They haven't been on anything else previously. We are going to team up. If you guys remember before Elul, remember how we had 4 weeks leading up, each one of us gave a shiur and it was open to all of our shuls. So I'm teaming up with a friend of mine, Rabbi Dov Winston, who's at the Young Israel Merrick, Rabbi Yitzhak Sprung, who's at United Orthodox Synagogues in Houston, Texas, and Rabbi Avi Schwartz, who's the director of OU JLIC at Rutgers. And, you know, it should be fun. We have a lot of fun topics lined up, and it's finalized at this point. And I'm waiting till February to start marketing it. So just to whet your appetites that it should hopefully be an exciting series and you get to hear somebody other than myself. So it should be a welcome break for you.
Yeah, Rabbi, plug Wednesday's Women's Speaker Series that you're going to present.
Oh, that's right. It's this Wednesday, yeah. Right? Yeah, it's this Wednesday.
Wednesday, yes, yes. Give it a plug. We need people. Talk about it for a minute.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to talk about, so you remember how we started talking about femininity, masculinity? We didn't really get that far.
Yes. Right. So, masculinity and femininity from the viewpoint of the Torah.
Yes. Yes. That's the plan. You know, a lot of the younger people in the community, not a lot of younger, some people who don't even attend our shul, they get upset when they see, men talking about these issues, or you know, according to them, you have to have a woman on to speak about it also, and representation, diversity. So, You know, the funny thing is the people who are most critical about this in our community don't even attend our shiurim at Congregation of Gudah Shalom. So it's for the most part, you know.
And what time is it, Rabbi? What's the time again?
1:30.
1:30.
1:30 on Zoom.
Yeah. I'm happy to meet in person also if you guys arrange that. But it seems like Zoom only for the time being, right?
It's so far, yes, it's Zoom. Yeah,
if you guys wanted to do it at the shul, I'm happy to do both. So it's up to you.
Yeah.
You just let me know. Okay?
So far, yeah, all right. Well, Anne will let you know.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking forward to learning with all of you. And okay, see you all soon. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. You too. Phil, I sent an email to everybody. Phyllis, you have to tell Kim Mahoney, and she'll send you the Zoom link.
Okay.
Hello?